Welcome to Seeking Alpha, the podcast where we're diving deep into crypto, careers, and the chaos of modern dating. I'm Larissa Bunzia.
And I'm Lindsay Poss. Together, we're two women who somehow found themselves at the intersection of crypto Twitter, Silicon Valley, and Tinder. Oh my God, Sebastian's here and he's wearing a shirt. Well,
this is so important. Special guest, Sebastian Schaefer. Dressed to impress.
All right, we're back.
We are fucking back. Welcome back to Seeking Alpha. We were in Cannes last week. That was so fucking fun and amazing and hot. However, many things went wrong, including my luggage being stolen. And not a carry-on, a full fucking check-size bag.
Yes, Larissa's luggage got stolen on a French train, to which my dad replied, she left her luggage alone on a French train. And I was like, okay. Okay, great.
Okay, Mr. Lindsay's dad.
In France. Yeah, also, poor Larissa couldn't stop sleeping the whole time, and I couldn't stop working the whole time. So it was actually super fun. Like, we found ways to have fun, but man,
we always
struggled.
It was super hot in temperature and actually both in people. South of France has perhaps the highest concentration of hot men I've ever seen.
Yeah, everybody, I got a hat tip to Southern France.
Including our Uber drivers. I almost went home with one, but then I remembered that I am myself now. I'm budgeting, professional, not going home with Uber drivers, Larissa.
Although it actually would have been really convenient for our budget if he would have driven us around for free because Ubers then were expensive. But
that's true.
Anyway, I want to give a huge shout out to Rave in particular. That's Ave's rave. They had an incredible time at their white party. It was truly, I think, like one of the best parties I've ever been to. I know all my friends and family think like, oh, you work in crypto and you go see the world. And it's like, you guys, I see mostly the insides of conference rooms at hotels, but there are so many once-in-a-lifetime experiences we get to have, and I'm so, so grateful for that. So, between Rave, the all-white party, like, on a mountain top overlooking Cannes during the sunset, incredible, and then spending a couple evenings in Monaco, like, we really were able to have a beautiful once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Yeah, we went to the crypto market IRL, aka the casino, and we're shocked to find how small the Monaco casino is. One blackjack table, and they took all my money.
Yeah, they did. That was sad to watch.
Anyways, I love sitting down and then getting a chip from guys to play.
Speaking of spending other people's money, what's happening in traditional finance?
Well, at first, we gotta give a shout out to our bestie Bitcoin for being at a new all-time high of over $120,000. Fucking incredible. All I gotta say is, institutions, why aren't you listening to our podcast? Because Lindsay told you to stop buying, and you're not listening.
I did. I wanted institutions to leave it all for us. But yeah, it was so funny when you asked to cover the all-time high, because you're like, we can't miss this moment. And I was like, there's going to be a new all-time high, and then a new one, and then a new one, and then a new one.
Yeah, so institutions are not only not leaving any of the Bitcoin for Lindsay, they're not leaving any for you, dear listener, because they're buying it all fucking up, and they don't even want you to know it. That is the worst part. So we talk a lot about why crypto is important for the developing world, aka the global south. Did you know that you're not supposed to say developing world anymore? I just learned that from my sister who's studying humanitarian stuff in grad school. It is now politically incorrect to say developing world.
That's so
the global south is like
a
place and sounds worse.
When I was in grad school for public policy and international relations, we were told to call it not the third world, because that had been like the thing. You know, we used to say first world, third world, and first world problems, all of that.
Where is the second world, by the way?
It's a term from communism. So first world was liberal democracies, and second world was communism, and then third world was impoverished or developing countries that hadn't yet been basically into one of the categories of first or second. But yeah, so we were told developing countries rather than third world nations.
Okay, well, once again,
Global South also works.
They've gotten it wrong again, because Global South is also a geographical place and is confusing, because Singapore, for example, is obviously the quote-unquote global north in this context, but it's very much in the south. So, wrong. Again, geopolitical pundits, fix
also,
it.
Also, are we listening to Schneebs now? Because I don't think so.
You're right. Okay, moving on. So, that's to say that Bitcoin is important not just for people in formerly the third world, now the global south, to be confirmed what the next term for it is, but for people whose economies aren't fully developed. It's also important for us USD holders, bank account owners, and we'll get into why. But net-net, high level, institutions are fucking racking this shit up, and they're doing it in secret. So, obviously, it means something for what you should be doing with your money.
OTC is a term that I've heard thrown around a ton. It means over the counter. So can you tell me more? Because obviously we know that the blockchain is transparent. Transactions are supposed to be able to be seen by all. So how does OTC trading like obfuscate that? And what does that mean for a retail customer who's like trying to not necessarily like compete with institutions, but we're all in the same marketplace?
Yeah, we're all buying the same Bitcoin. Yeah,
we're all buying the same Bitcoins. Whether you're an institution, you're a retail investor, a government, whatever, we're all buying from the same pool. So when you're saying like OTC is happening in secret, like how is that happening and why is that bad for everyone else who's in that pool trying to buy the asset?
Yeah, so just quick note here, we're going to refer to OTC trading as buying Bitcoin, but it's also all other crypto assets. Bitcoin is just simpler to say and funner to say because, woo, Bitcoin. So to take a step back, institutions aren't buying like a little bit of Bitcoin at a time. They're not us dollar cost averaging, aka buying weekly and figuring that the price will even itself out across all of our purchases. They're buying massive positions. And so the way that they used to have to do this a couple of years ago is through an exchange, just like all of us do. So we're all on Coinbase or Kraken or other or a DEX, a decentralized exchange if you're more technical. Exchanges have open order books. So you can see the positions that people are taking. You can see when people are buying, you can see when people are selling. And if institutions were taking large-scale positions in Bitcoin, it was obviously a bullish signal for the market and an indication that the price is being pushed up through their purchase. And then you knew if you were somebody who looks for market signals, you knew to then be buying yourself or sell at the top, whatever. Anyway, the point is that momentum was honest, price discovery was public, everybody knew what was going on, and that was beautiful. It was transparent, it was working the way it's supposed to. Now, institutions are buying behind a closed door through OTC trading. And so what they do is they go to an OTC firm, for example, Wintermute, Galaxy, Cumberland, and they say, hey, I want to buy some fucking Bitcoin and I don't want anybody to know it. And so these trades happen off public exchanges. So they go to one of these firms and the OTC desk becomes their middleman. So they match the buyer with the seller. Often it's another whale who's offloading a bunch of Bitcoin. And the OTC desk negotiates a price, and it's usually better than what the price is on public exchanges. So,
wait, can we pause really quick? Yes. I just want to point out that I had no idea that the firms were matching buyers and sellers. I thought actually the firms held the Bitcoin. So it's very interesting to me that whales themselves are also participating. Like you have a two-sided marketplace where both sides are participating kind of in like price manipulation.
Right.
So that's very interesting.
Yeah, the OTC desk is effectively operating like as a broker. And the trade clears. This is the worst part. The trade clears off-chain, and it's usually on custom settlement terms through private wallets. But there's no impact on the order book, so you can't see that it's happening on a public exchange. The public never sees it. No one knows until weeks later when the charts finally catch up. So after a company makes the disclosure publicly, for whatever reason, that they've bought X amount of Bitcoin. And the worst part, it's bad that it's happening off-chain. Even worse is that they're fucking telling you that it's a bubble, that it's a scam, that it's not happening. They're lying.
I want to make sure the they in this case is the institutions that are buying off-chain. So I want to make sure we're clear about who they are.
It's the same fucking people who are on CNBC, on Bloomberg, with their CEO saying that it's a scam, that it's going to zero. Those are the institutions. The first time I learned that OTC trading exists, I was sitting in a crypto panel. This was in 2018. And a major influencer at the time, LOL Crypto Crow was his name, he was so impassioned on stage talking about how the institutions are liars, because that day Goldman Sachs was on stage at another TradFi conference talking about how Bitcoin is a joke and how it's never going to be taken seriously by asset managers, by traditional financiers. And they had been making an OTC trade that day, that same exact day, of like $2 billion for Bitcoin. So buying and lying about it is what institutions have been doing for years.
This actually reminds me a lot of the GameStop incident too, when everyone was like, everyone on Wall Street bets wins and the little traders finally get to make a buck. As if every single trading firm didn't make a bazillion dollars off of the GameStop price massive increase. access to information retail traders have. Firms have it a thousandfold, and they were able to cash the hell in on the GameStop nonsense. I actually read a whole op-ed about this in 2021. And then they made that movie with Pete Davidson, like, oh, the little guy won. Like, that's such bullshit. Like, the little guy never wins. Didn't win at GameStop, not winning at Bitcoin. Like, the institutions always have a leg up.
They always eat first. There are so many reasons why this is fucking appalling, but among the top is that Wintermute, one of the biggest OTC trading desks in the world, they just reported that in the first half of 2025, their OTC volumes outpaced centralized exchange volumes by 2.5 times, over 2.5 times. So significantly more buying is happening OTC than on centralized exchanges.
Over double is happening.
And exchanges is like the biggest signal to the market as to how assets are doing, and all this stuff is happening behind closed doors. So there's no real-time price transparency, no impact on spot prices, which is what retail, what we buy, and there's no signal to the market until it's way too late. So while you're on your Coinbase app trying to stock prices and figure out when the right time is to buy, Larry Fink is out there buying tens of millions in Bitcoin, and the price doesn't change.
That's so painful. It's exactly like stock buybacks or stock price manipulation or whatever. Like, it's just, yeah, it's just
it's
the big people controlling the market, which is exactly what Bitcoin
is. Completely, yeah.
And to combat.
Completely antithetical to the point of crypto. And it's like, to put it in simple, relatable terms, like, you're sitting in a restaurant, you did all your research to find the best fucking restaurant in town, and you're ordering a la carte, and you're saying, like, I'm getting the best possible item in the best possible restaurant, and then this fucking Brad and Chad next to you in their suits and their fucking Gucci shoes are getting caviar and Moet, and you didn't even see those on the menu, because they're not, because they're ordering... And they cost less. And they're getting heaps of fucking caviar, and you don't even see it on the menu because they're ordering from a waiter that works exclusively for them that is told not to tell you what is going on.
Yikes. Okay, so I want to, like, wrap this back around to everyday listeners, though, because on the one hand, obviously, this is hugely problematic from a structural point of view, but none of us really have any power over that. So from a more pragmatic point of view, what this functionally means is, like, buy Bitcoin, which is, I hate saying that, but the thing is, like, when you're looking at these assets that are being bought up by major institutions, first of all, a fraction of a fraction that you buy means that the institutions can't have it. The second thing is, these institutions want these assets, clearly. Like, there's a want for these. And so you're going to be able to use that against them in the future. And I was thinking about this a lot because when our parents were establishing wealth, a lot of it was through real estate. You know, you could buy a house in the 80s for $100K that's now worth $1.5 million. And those homes were then used as the financial starting point for so many other things. Collateral for businesses, being able to take out car loans, whatever it is. Like, homes become the center point of the way that you're able to build wealth for your family. And we are not going to have that same opportunity because real estate is so out of touch. And so we have to think about wealth creation differently. And that's where having these assets, because they're clearly so in demand by huge institutions, is going to be hugely important. Like, that's going to be the collateral that we're able to borrow against. Like, no longer are you going to take out home equity lines of credit. You're going to take out a loan against the amount of Bitcoin that you own. And because the banks want that Bitcoin on the other side, because it's a scarce resource, it will actually mean something to be able to do that. And so every, like, little bit that you buy is a bit that is going to be passed down in future generations. Every piece of Bitcoin that I own, I know that I will never sell because I will pass it down. It will be an asset the same way a house is that my kids can use to borrow against in the future. And that helps create wealth past my lifetime. And so when I think about buying, like, that's what I legitimately think about, is like every fraction of a fraction is something that can be used later. And it's just, like, so wild to me, though, that we're having to learn asset management and wealth creation, like, via these means. Like, our world is just getting so much more complicated. Oh my God. Like, I remember our house was the thing that was able to pay for my mom's, like, cancer. Like, we took out a home equity line of credit against that to be able to pay medical bills. Having these assets in your portfolio to be able to do things like that is so important. And, like, for us, so many of us are locked out of the real estate market that, like, it is extremely important to find other avenues for that, for right now, for later in life, for your family, whatever. It's kind of sad that we have to do it in this complicated fashion.
Hey, it's not that complicated. All you gotta do, take out your phone, download an app, put in your bank account information, and you can buy Bitcoin. It's not that complicated.
Yeah, of course,
anymore.
But the economy around it looks different too. I could go to my mortgage broker right now and say I need a home equity line of credit, and there's a whole process. I just have to fill out some paperwork or whatever, but I'd be guided. Taking out collateral against my Bitcoin is like a way more opaque thing to do at the moment. And obviously those tools will improve as they have to, but for right now, it's just such a brand new way of doing wealth generation, wealth accumulation, that like the whole ecosystem around it is not there. So that's what I'm saying.
For sure. And it's improving though. I mean, banks now, for the first time, you can take out a mortgage against your Bitcoin. Which is incredible.
Yeah,
so it's getting more sophisticated.
It's awesome, but yeah, things are definitely not there yet.
Yeah, but it's getting there. And this is especially important because people are constantly telling me that they feel like it's too late to buy Bitcoin. They're too late. No. And they're not going to have the same opportunity for upside as people who bought at, say, $50,000 or $20,000 when Bitcoin was at that price.
But you're also you're going to have more upside than the person who buys at $180.
Exactly. I don't know how many ways we can say, and hopefully this is the catalyst that some people need, that institutions are fucking buying this shit en masse in private, which means that they don't want you to know because they want the best prices for themselves because they know it's going to continue going up. And we can talk about in another episode. Sorry, Lindsay, we'll have to talk about Bitcoin again. But all the reasons why institutions are buying it, because there are plenty. We've talked about some in the past, but just high level, U.S. debt, fucking clownery, inflation, persistent, geopolitical instability, rising, no sign of ending. And that's just the start.
Larissa is the good news bear today, everyone.
As always.
National debt, clownery. That's my favorite one.
Clownery. Fucking shenanigans. By the way, did you see that there was an op-ed in the Washington Post by an actual clown, like a professional clown, who was like, stop calling Trump one of us?
Oh my gosh. Clowns are standing up.
They're offended that Trump is being associated with them. They're like, this is serious business. Stop associating that fool with
it's
us.
Serious business. Okay. Sure.
Compared to what Trump is doing.
That's so good. Oh, God. Ugh, justice for the clowns. I'm team clown now.
You can't make that shit up. You cannot. No. Who would have thought? There are things that happen, like poly market, the prediction market, and market for whether Zelensky will wear a suit or not. There are some things that happen that are so crypto that are like, imagine explaining this to somebody in the year 2000. They would never believe you. But then it's like clowns writing op-eds about being associated with Trump. Like, that's the kind of shit that, like, you really just cannot make up.
And I know. I think about this all the time. I'm like, what would 15-year-old me have said about, like, my job and my life right now? And, like, she would have had no idea what I was talking about. So crazy.
Jesus.
Okay, well, in further good news, let's talk about employees and employers.
Yeah, so Goldman Sachs, known extraordinarily well for their ethics, is upset about the unethical practice of investment banks poaching junior employees. They're now demanding that junior bankers swear an oath of loyalty every 3 months. So every 3 months, junior bankers have to sign something that says, I'm happy with Goldman Sachs, I'm loyal to Goldman Sachs, and I'm not looking for other jobs. Apparently, these firms are stealing Goldman's young cherubs right after they've completed their proprietary training program. All of a sudden, they're scooped up by a firm that is giving them more flexible hours, better quote-unquote work-life balance, and I say that because we know how I feel about work-life balance, but better pay, better everything, and Goldman Sachs is upset. So this news actually came to us from Pirate Wires, which, shout out, love them. The headline in Pirate Wire was Booty Margin Call, and there's really no better way that I can put this into words than the way that the author did, which was, after a decade of flaccid feminine floundering, this is exactly the kind of masculine fire the industry needs. And why stop there? I want to see a Goldman managing director, red-hot branding rod held high, bearing down to sear GS into the hairless cheeks of an analyst's youthful bottom. So, very tastefully put, Pirate Wires. But it got me thinking about the era of traditional employee loyalty being dead and gone forever, and the fact that employers now need to reckon with it, and maybe instead of contractually obliging their employees to be there forever, they should think about some reasons why employees would want to be loyal to them.
Yeah, no, this is just wholesale dumb. It's just, if you want your employees to stay because you've just put an effort into training them, then make their lives good. It's not that hard to figure out.
I think we're living in a time that's really different. Boomers were fiercely loyal to their companies, so much so that they would be there for 40 years and then get fired in an email, because the way that we work now is moving to opportunities that are better.
So there was a change, and this started with Milton Friedman, a famous economist from the Chicago School of Economics. He published a paper on switching from using several metrics to judge success to just working on profit maximizing for shareholders. So prior to the Friedman way of thinking, which took off in the 80s and 2000s, for those of you that know, Jack Welch of GE is seen as this like titan of industry, ultimate CEO. He was a huge proponent of the Milton Friedman method, one of the first to implement it and turned around GE's profits. But what all that comes at is the cost of all of these other things that you're talking about with like boomers being able to stay loyal to their jobs. So prior to profit maximization, the ways that companies measured success were in profits, but were also in things like employee satisfaction, community impact, market share, community standing, and long-term stability. Companies were seen as long-term plays. That's when we saw a lot of things like pension plans and things that really locked an employee into a long-term contract intentionally on both sides. They were meant to be long-term stable places to live, grow, earn market share, have good community and social responsibility, and invest in their employees. Like, that was the goal of a company. So it switched to shareholder and profit maximization. And I don't want to completely knock that, because that kind of short-term thinking, and it's also led to some of the greatest innovations we've ever had. And so it does move an economy along significantly faster. I do think overall, in my personal opinion, it is worse, but I don't want to say that it's whole cloth worse and there's no advantages, because there are. But anyways, when we moved away from that model, employee loyalty was basically completely broken. This was when it started to be like layoffs were really popular. This is when we saw compensation really escalate into being stock prices and stock shares for C-suite executives. So their incentives didn't become happy companies. It became, how can we profit maximize? And that's when you start to see like a lot more stock price manipulation, churn and burn of employees. Layoffs are very interesting, because layoffs actually make a signal to the market that that company is getting serious about cutting costs, which sends the stock price up. So regular layoffs are actually a sign of like you are managing effectively. And so that becomes part of the strategy to increase those profits.
Yes. Interesting. I would think that it would send the stock down because it signaled that the company wasn't doing so well. But you're saying it sends the stock up,
no,
typically.
It sends the stock up because it signals that the company is serious either about turning around what's going wrong or about maximizing efficiency. It's interpreted as we're being serious about our strategy moving forward and we are making moves around that. And so that typically sends the stock price up. This is also because, again, CEOs and executives are starting to get stock. That's when you see stock price manipulation. You see huge amounts of buybacks, all this stuff. It's very related actually to OTC trading and like the way that manipulates the market price of Bitcoin. Like, then you see companies manipulating the market price of their stock. So it's no longer about how much market share do you have, how effective and efficient are you, how are your employees treated, all the things that make a good company. It's much more about how is the stock price doing, which kind of sucks. From the employee side, you do see the transition too from pensions to things like 401ks, the slashing of benefits, all of that, which are obviously net worse for employees, but again, to your point, do allow for greater mobility. If the employee wants to go through a 3-month training program that JP Morgan invests in super heavily and then leave, they can do that. They can go to a place. They have zero obligation to be at that company anymore. And I think in later generations, we're starting to see this trend where length at companies goes down with age. So the younger you are, the less likely you are to stay at a company for a long time. I think that what's happening is people are starting to move away from their parents' thoughts that like, a company is loyal to you, you should be loyal to a company and all of that, and starting to realize, you know, these companies,
yeah, because companies really aren't loyal
care.
To you.
Yeah. These companies don't care, and so we can just go find something that we like more.
As long as you're leveling up each time, I think it makes sense to continue changing and not look at your company as a like stationary place. It sounds like people used to think of companies as kind of like homes, yeah, where they would be invested in staying there. The company would be invested in having them and really make it work. Like, that doesn't happen anymore. I have gotten backlash from people in my family who are more traditionally minded because I have, quote unquote, skipped around a lot in my decade in the professional workforce. But in reality, I've always been poached to much better, much higher paying jobs. And as somebody who has sought candidates, I have looked at people's job changes from 1 year to the other as something that, you know, like, it's an opportunity for them to explain during an interview. And of course, like, it can mean that they're not somebody who is able to stay at a role, like, on the one hand, but on the more likely hand, it's just that they're a really valuable person and their results are clear and companies want them. They're a high demand candidate. And so they've always taken the best next step for themselves. And that's something that I reward when I'm looking for job candidates. It's not something that's a deterrent at all.
No, definitely not. And looking at the breakdown of why people leave too, so many people leave because they don't feel like they're invested in. That's like the number one, you know, basically, like, I see no path forward. There's no clear way to move up. There's no clear way to learn new skills. There's no clear way to get anything else out of that job than what you've gotten. And that is also because employers have that ability to continue doing short-term things over and over and over. And so it creates this kind of self-feeding cycle where you go to a place short-term, you learn what you can, you leave, and then you keep going. But to your point, that says nothing really about the employee. That's just how it is. And yeah. If you want people to stay for a long time, you have to invest in them. You have to create pathways where they can learn and move up. And actually, one company that does this fantastically is Costco. Costco and Walmart both do this. When you manage a Walmart store, you can make $250,000, whatever. Almost all of them are employees who started in the store. And that is so incredibly rare. And it's the same thing with Costco. And so they have super, super high rates of people staying for an incredibly long time because they offer pathways up. They pay their lowest paid people well. And then they offer, Costco offers full health benefits. They offer all these extras too that allow people to stay for a long time. And then you get really satisfied employees. And to be honest, like, Costco is a coveted job, which is really crazy to think about. But that's what happens. Or those are just two companies in a sea that don't do that. And certainly no tech companies like that.
Yeah, I don't see fucking Goldman Sachs doing that. No. I see them treating their employees like shit. And then having
whining,
them work.
Having
them sign, some shit about not looking for better opportunities. I mean, I think that companies need to realize, like, the reality is that, like, in a global 24/7 job marketplace where employees can be remote, where the opportunities are infinite, people are always going to be trying to level up. And if you're not providing room for them to level up internally, it's natural that they're going to seek better opportunities externally, or opportunities are going to come to them, because a lot of companies, especially in, like, the crypto space, are hiring and looking for the best talent across all industries.
Well, so to sum up, buy Bitcoin, never be loyal to a job. And we are starting a new segment.
Lindsay, what's it called?
It's called Things We Like.
Until we get a better name. Somebody
Until
give
we
us
get
one.
A better name. It's just called Things We Like this week. But yeah.
Yeah.
Larissa, what did you like this week?
So I just read this fucking fabulous book called The Snakehead. Super interesting. 5 stars on Goodreads. And basically it's like The Sopranos, but in human smuggling form, with the linchpin being this little old lady, this grandma called Sister Ping, who created this multi-billion dollar human smuggling ring. It follows like this one shipwreck that happened when, like, over 300 people were put into this, like, tiny ass cargo ship from China to the US. It chronicles kind of like their struggles in trying to become citizens after being persecuted in China for having more than one child. So that's what I liked. Not the human smuggling component, but the book itself. My favorite kind, which is a nonfiction book, informative book that's written in, like, narrative form. So it reads like a fiction book, but it's all true. It actually reads like a horror book. And now every time I swim, I think about it. I think about these 300 people who were cast off the ship and had to swim for their lives. And as somebody who's not a strong swimmer, when I was in the French Riviera, I was trying to pretend like I was swimming ashore for my life, and I'm not confident I would make it. I would absolutely latch myself onto Lindsay and we would both drown.
You have little faith. I'd pull us to safety. But yeah, adding that to the list, because 5 stars on Goodreads is huge.
Okay, so everyone, Lindsay, what did you like this week?
So I am at the beach out on Long Island, and it's beautiful. And so my thing that I like this week is a Supergoop sunscreen, which sounds lame, But Supergoop is the best. I have their tinted and their regular face moisturizer, and it's the first sunscreen I've ever put on that, like, doesn't feel goopy and icky and weird. And their Unseen sunscreen in particular is, like, it's like putting air on your face. It's so nice. I can't describe
that
the
feeling. That sounds so nice.
Yes. Yeah. Supergoop Daily Sunscreen is where I live.
I never use sunscreen, but air what? On my face. Stick to the segment topic.
No, I can't. Skin cancer. What are you talking about? I sunscreen myself every 30 minutes on my body and twice daily on my face.
But maybe now I'll start because air on my face sounds beautiful. Yeah, you might really have nice. Just convinced me.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I'm going to lather you up next time. No wonder why you got sunburnt while we were in Miami.
Hey. On that note. Thank you guys for listening.
What a sad episode. We'll be funny next week.
Yeah.
Or when next we talk episode. About
maybe national weeks. Debt, maybe clowner, maybe some more clownery, maybe some more Bitcoin. But
I
Lindsay
really
won't let
do
me.
A like smash or pass segment on like would you have this person's baby for money mostly? Like would you accept the fertilized egg of this person?
Okay.
I have a whole list.
Next up on Seeking yeah. Alpha, smash or pass. A clown.
Depends on the clown.
Okay. Fair answer. Who's a famous clown? Oh, Trump. Huh. Yeah,
exactly. Pass. Hard pass.
Okay. Yikes. Well, thank you guys so much for listening.
Yeah.
Love you.
Five-star ratings and reviews. Send it to a friend. Follow us on everything. We love you. Bye.